Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're about to share with you a conversation I had earlier today with the great actor Danny Glover, who is here to, as he talks about, getting energized by the form itself and to add his energy to this form. It was an amazing conversation, and it's our pleasure to bring that conversation now. I'm interviewing Danny Glover here at Cobble Hall. You're such an accommodating brother, man. You just
A friend of mine, Joe Marshall, has a group called Omega's Boys Club in San Francisco and Bay Area. We've been knowing each other since 19 years old. He said when he went from South Central L.A. to USF, University of San Francisco, his grandmother told him, if you know, you owe.
Amen. That's true. That's true.
Amen. Amen to grandma.
That's true.
Because he taught school for a while, and then he started this extraordinary group called Mega Boys Club, Street Soldiers, trying to rehab young people's lives, young boys' lives and everything. And they know them all, and people know them all over the country. And so, in one sense, you know, I'm excited. I mean, this is right here. We see right here where there's the 34-year-old director for the last 2 years of Trans Africa Forum and Nicole, who's dynamic, to her young staff, to all of it. This is where the voices are. This is where the leadership is built, right here. And so, if I can say something, to be a part of, to talk about, you mm-hmm. know, from my own, you know, experience, you know. And I don't want to be like those other cats. A lot of people talking about what I did 40 years ago.
Right.
Doesn't matter what you did 40 years
ago.
What are you doing? What's happening now? Right. You know, 40 years ago, 42 years ago, we were on strike at San Francisco State when I studied. But that's past. You know, what are we doing now?
Right.
When we had a reunion for the 4th anniversary, I'm gonna say it's good, but you tend to romanticize those moments and then lose perspective on what really happened mm-hmm. and what you need to be doing now. I want to know what we've been doing now. If 40 years ago, what we did was important, what we're doing now is even more important, you know. And then I got one of the cats, I got my teacher about this, the guy who's been doing it since he sat down with a young preacher when the young preacher was 26 and he was 28. Harry Belafonte.
Oh, yes.
That's the cat in my life, you know.
And you'll be here with him tomorrow night, right? Or does Friday night or Sunday?
Is he coming? He's coming here?
Yeah, he's coming right here. Yeah,
beautiful. Beautiful. I talked to him. I said, Harry, you got to come. We had dinner together. I said, Harry, you know, and when people have been on there, I said, Harry, you got to come, man. In fact, we had dinner together. The last two Saturdays, we had dinner together, you know, and talked about that. And I said, I know Tuesday's out, the opening's out, but we got to come because they need to hear your voice, man. And it's a voice that still resonates. It's still trying to work it out, trying to work with and watching young people empower themselves, trying to preach the ideas of nonviolence and the King's ideals and everything. He's out there, man. He's really, you know, it's been my, you know, especially the last 25 years. Of knowing Harry Belafonte. We met 30 years ago. That's 25 years have been some of the richest moments in my life.
I'm sure. I've only had a chance to meet him once or twice, but he's just an amazing human being. He's never lost his commitment to all this,
never,
to the struggle to make a better world.
Never lost his commitment. Never, you know.
This. One of the things that you talked about, the young people here, I'm curious about your observation about that. One of the things that hit me was that 40 years ago, there were a lot of middle-class kids who really fought in the war and poverty and stuff like this. Mm-hmm. But what we're seeing here is these are young working-class kids. This is a whole another world, like, bubbling up from the bottom that is just amazing to watch. It's blowing my mind watching this happen here.
Well, I think they're very interesting because I represent 63 years old. I represent that first generation.
We're the same age then.
Yeah. Right, the same generation who came out of... whose parents had moved from the South. And my father and mother, my mother was from rural Georgia, real poor rural Georgia, managed to graduate, be the first to graduate in family from college, met my dad in New York, and landed in San Francisco, where I was born and raised. And so I'm the first generation, Matt. And a great deal of what we saw, a lot of the focus certainly on, as we watch the movement, young people who were in some sense breaking that kind of ideological wall with the Eisenhower years and the 50s and everything, to see that breakout. A lot of young, middle-class people were involved in that. A lot of people who, in some sense, tried to find some distance between their parents and themselves at that particular point in time. And their parents, for the most part, a great deal of their parents had built whatever they had built in life over a period of time. They weren't handed it to them. Right. So at one point, they were working at working class right. people as well. So in this sense, we're that generation in that sense that broke into this and created in a moment, a strategic moment. And I think as we look at now historically in the redefinition of the first major war that wasn't a war, Vietnam War. It was a war. It was a war in which that men, young men were dying. It was a war that, as King talked about, took resources from the really making the kind of communities and fighting the war on poverty. All those kind of things we saw happening. And this extraordinary groundswell really came to a halt with the assassination of King and the assassination of Robert Kennedy, who was basically on his way to being, I believe, something special in terms
could
of
have been.
Had the possibility of being something special. So we find this period where we find this kind of breakup of all these movements. Now these movements came from movements from throughout the 20th century and the last part of the century, build the labor movements, movements around, I mean, defiant movements. You have Jewish working people coming in and defiant, building movements, joining those alternative parties and working, and all the kind of the black people and inserting themselves in it, and working people, these movements that became political in a sense, you know what I'm saying? But the first attempt to attack them was basically after World War II. With the McCarthyism,
UAC, and all that,
base movement to disintegrate that, you know, and certainly what we saw in fragmentations of that emerged in the civil rights movement and became a part of our legacy in the movement. That's a part of our legacy, but something that happened really that ramped and changed this whole dynamic, and that's the idea of consumption, the idea that with our movement. This movement of young people, those who were disbanding or changing the relationship with their family, was a relationship that also said that we're not going to become consumers, that we're going to put a stop to this. We're looking for an alternative way of living. That now was overridden by this whole enormous movement of consumption and transforming this world, not only this country, this world, into a commodity in a sense. Every single thing became a commodity. Mm-hmm. We ourselves became a commodity in a sense. So what I see young people here, in some sense, in the aggressiveness of something that they are born into, that they inherit, that they themselves are, in some sense, are indoctrinated into, finding a way to break that. And finding a way to break that from a different thing, because they're talking about something else we couldn't talk about as young people. The word, Mother Earth.
Right.
The possibility of Mother Earth not being there. The changes in Mother Earth. The sustainability of life itself. All those things become the things on their plate. So to see grassroots people here begin to kind of ingratiate themselves, engage themselves in that discussion, along with those other people right here, is something that's really, really, I think, for me, just hardening, you know, because I can't talk about development, whether it's community development in New Orleans, or community development here, or community development anywhere in the world, or community development in the global south, without talking about climate change, and without talking about global warming, and what does that mean, without talking about the waste, without talking about all of it, and what does that mean? How do we now become, you know, the architects of challenging the architects of our own rescue? How do we become that? The young people are the face of that. Yeah.
And I mean, that's the fact that you set in 40 years ago and then became an actor mm-hmm. and this other world opened up in your life.
Yeah.
But you have remained inside the struggle. Every time I turn around, I see you're somewhere else trying to give support to pieces of different movements around this country and around the globe.
Well, one of the things that's important is the reason why you do certain things. I realized when my life began to shift in around 1970, I was part of the Model Cities program. I worked in the Model Cities program for 6 years. Uh-huh. I worked in the Office of Community Development in San Francisco 6 years in my early 20s uh-huh. until I left when I was 30 years old. You know, and so the part of that was, in some sense, I get caught up with the extension of that. You know, I worked in right. my life in community development was about 10 years from the time I worked with the Western District Community Organization. We went to the meetings as students in 1967. They were trying to, at that particular point, I was 20 years old. We were trying to gentrify, what we call gentrify, mm-hmm. the black community in there. And it was successful. And so people began to organize that. So that was my first, outside of watching as a child the civil rights movement, that's my first glimpse of people actually and involved and engaged them, actually organizing people from every different demographic, age demographic, from old people to young people to working people, Japanese, African-American, Latino, being a part of the WACO. WACO was it called, Western District Community Organization. That was the first time that I saw this possibility happening right now. And so when that period, with that period of time, and watching that evolution and being involved in the aftermath of that, which was the war, the extended war on poverty, the Model Cities Program, the Office of Community, all these faces, which in one sense was opening a space for young people, that baby boomers, to become engaged, involved, jobs, that provided mm-hmm. jobs, federal funding to provide a job. It was actually a job, a workforce.
I had the same jobs. I know that.
You know
yeah,
what I'm
right,
saying? That's
right,
what it was.
Right.
You know, the private sector didn't provide those kind of jobs, but they are just siphoning off young people in some sense, and with the ideals. I mean, people, when I was going to college, they weren't working toward an MBA. They were working toward being a teacher. Still working toward MSW. Exactly.
Like right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Because of the ideals, the nature of the ideals, right. and the acculturation that we had gone through. So this is the whole process that's happening. So when I decided that acting out of first recreation, simply just doing something recreational, became something I was doing. It's when I discovered the work of Ethel Fugard. If I don't discover Ethel Fugard, the great South African playwright,
oh
I'm not an
God.
Actor.
He's the most amazing writer.
I'm not an actor.
Yeah. What did you do first?
The first Fugard I did was 1976 when I was going to the American Conservatory of Theater, and we had been doing scene studies about doing monologues in the Slade of Bloodline. Bloodline was the first thing I did. You know, my first introduction to Fugard in 1975 was the Bloodline.
Oh, man.
And my friend came, and we did that. We ended up doing it as a student project where both of us were on stage for 4 hours.
That was my first Fugard play, too. I did that play.
You know what I'm saying? Bloodline, you're morning.
Oh, yes. What a play. That's the most amazing play.
My.
Oh God, coming down the can't stop the car.
How are you, a woman? What's that? You don't recognize me?
Yes.
To tell the truth, the whole truth, to help me, God, I made a change. Beautiful sight. You know what I'm saying? Tells us all of a sudden, yeah. it framed my cultural work. It framed the work for me in a certain way, and not only it framed for me, it taught me the craft of acting. Mm-hmm. You don't learn the craft of acting unless you do great work. Arthur Miller. Lorraine Hansberry, right. Death of a Salesman. Great play. Oh, you don't learn the craft of acting unless you do great work. So it framed, in some sense, not I begin to frame. So it was that place. I did Cesare Bonzi in 1977, and we were using that. I was working with African Liberation Support Committee. We're using performances to raise money and resources, I may have to say it, for ZANU. You know, it's mm-hmm. in my way in 1977.
Those are we all supported that back then, though.
We all supported ZANU back then. We all supported ZANU back then.
Right.
So on the one hand, so it contextualized my work
right.
and my reason for doing this. If I don't have that, so as always, so I ended up on Broadway, I ended up in L.A. In 1978 doing The Island, which is one of my favorites. The mm-hmm. Island is It's killer. The island, and then ended up in New York in 1979, 1980, off Broadway doing Blood Knot, and ended up on Broadway in 1982. So all of a sudden, I'm doing a major Fugard play in 1982 in the middle of the struggle for sanctions against South Africa. Right. It's considered the best play of the year in New York, and I'm in a major. So now I have a national platform. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And so essentially, to talk about Denzel Washington, Blair Underwood, myself, and Alfie Woodard formed Artists Against Apartheid in 1987. After I did Mandela, which I was in 1986, we were kind of back. So you kind of get an idea, you know. But I had been involved in the African Liberation Support Committee right after I finished school in San Francisco. In fact, I remember the arguments and the discussions between, do you support MPLA or do you support UNITA?
Oh, yes, right.
I mean, we had drag out fights behind that. You know, the cultural nationalists.
Of course, you were MPLA, right?
Yeah, of course, MPLA. Yeah, the cultural nationalists. I can say that now. but I did. It's definitely, you know, right. Definitely MPLA. Right. You know, because we understood essentially. Those are the dialectics. Mm-hmm. You understand? You know, because a great deal of us had not only that. My major was economics. You know, and a great deal of that is studying Marxist economics and other alternative economic systems and everything else, and ideas around, different ideas around that. So of course, it was definitely MPLA, you know.
So I got to ask this question. I imagine I'm digressing this, but you're coming to Baltimore tomorrow.
I'm coming to Baltimore tomorrow.
Why are you coming to Baltimore?
I'm coming to Baltimore for healthcare workers tomorrow. In Baltimore, the big mobilization of healthcare workers in Baltimore, it is important. It's Thursday. One Thursday afternoon. The rally is from 4:30 to 6. I'm going to make a quick dash to Baltimore and then come back here. But the beautiful thing about this movement, building a consensus around healthcare workers organizing themselves, is that the one out of five jobs in Baltimore is a healthcare.
That's right.
Is healthcare worker.
That's right.
You know. And I can imagine that one out of five of them, four of those are not in union, not unionized, you know.
Right.
So it's a big moment. I've come there. We've been planning this for some time. It's a big rally. I think Charles Dutton's going to be there. I hope he's there. Yeah. Good friend of mine.
You got to take a digression. First thing, I had to tell you this. You know how I met Charles Dutton?
Hi.
I ran the theater program in the prison. That's how I met Dutton.
Well, you know how I met, you know Charles and I met? Charles and I met when I was at Yale Rep doing Master Hell and the Boys in 1982.
Oh, he was a student
at Yale Rep. He had come from, he'd gone to, he graduated from
Towson University.
Yeah, right. And then went on to, it's beautiful.
After he graduated prison.
But Charles is going to be
so
there.
So he's going to be at the rally?
He's going to be at the rally.
That's
tomorrow.
Great.
I'm pretty sure he's going to be at the rally.
That's
know?
Good.
Yeah.
So now, I heard you talking earlier about the films you've been producing at Cannes that nobody's paying attention to.
Well,
talk a bit about that for a second.
Well, one of the things that I decided to do, and this came with, I just happened to, sometime in your life you meet someone who's incredibly brilliant in terms, and also wants to use their brilliance in the service of changing the dynamic. I did a film in Dakar, Senegal, in 1999, called Batu. It is a fictitious story about the beggars going on strike after structural adjustments. This country going through structural adjustments, and their job was to get rid of all the beggars. Because in a Muslim country, part of the alms is giving to those who are less fortunate, and giving is a part of that. And it's a really incredible story about this fictitious country. And I went to do that with a friend of mine, director Sheku Masusoko. And I had been a long time before Mandela been trying to situate myself in terms of how can I help in some way of elevating African films, their presence, you know. Ousmane Sembene was a good friend of mine. The old man was a good friend of mine. I'd grown up in the mid-70s watching African films from Suleiman Sisi to Jibril to particularly Sembene, all those films I had seen, and was fascinated by it as they kind of grapple with the issues post-colonialism.
Right.
You know, and one of my favorite books was a book, one of my all-time favorite books, and I think one of the most important novels written post-colonialism, was Ousmane Sembene's God's Bits of Wood. Fascinating book about a railway strike that takes place in 1947. It changes from on the Dakar-Bamako line. It changes the whole nature of the anti-colonial struggle. So I met this woman, Jocelyn Bourne, who had gotten the rights to the book by a Senegalese woman. She was fluent in French and wrote in French. She's American. She translated it and adapted it into a script. And we went about Sheikh Omar, the director, to do it. So when I was at the FESPACO in 1999, Sheikh asked me if I would do it. I had not met her before. We got on the set as we went through doing the film, and we began talking about things we wanted to do. And I mentioned the Haitian Revolution and Toussaint Louverture, and it's like a light, like the set. And our worlds have changed, and our worlds have been inseparable from that moment on 11 years ago. And mentioned that. We wrote a script. Out of that script, we wrote the script. We came a film company called Louverture Films. We produced a film on this celebrating the 60th birthday of Bob Marley, Africa Unite. We produced a film about Katrina called Trouble the Water. Yeah, we were producing the film.
Yeah,
the film, found all the money to do the film. We produced a film about the African debt crisis called Bamako, which we were producing on that film as well. You know, I met my next best, Adiraman Sissoko. We were on the jury of a film festival in Amiens, France, and I'd seen his film before. Waiting for Happiness was an incredible film about migration, and I asked him, "What's his next film?" He said, "I'm doing a film. We're gonna put the World Bank on trial." And like, I'm in. I'm in. I'm talking about. I'm in. Give me the film. And we started. We put money in the film and supported the film. We produced that. We produced a film by Anna Marie Giasour, the first Palestinian woman to direct a feature film called Salt of the Sea.
I've heard this one. I've seen it.
And we were producers on a film, a documentary on music of the Civil Rights Movement called Soundtrack to Revolution.
Oh, you did that one too?
Yeah. We were producers. We raised all the money. We found an ingenious way to raise the money. By getting five people on the board, including myself, on the board of the Jazz Foundation of America, to put up about 66%, two-thirds of the money, and then we found the other money to do that. We produced that from scratch. We're producing on a film that won the Palme d'Or this year. A Thai director, Apatat Pong. Uncle Boomney, who sees his past lives. We produced on that. We produced on the film that should have been a major winner last year, Ilya Suleiman's The Time That Remains, Palestinian director, probably one of the best directors in the world.
About the Nakba.
Huh?
About the Nakba.
Yeah.
About the 48 on the other side.
Yeah, the other side. We produced on that. We were developing a script on the relationship between Paul Robeson and Albert Einstein. They're both co-chairs of the anti-lynching campaign in 1946. And We're developing, that's the kind of work that we're doing, and the film that we developed on the Haitian Revolution, which we've been working on, which is a passion of mine for I did Color Purple 25 years ago. Yeah. I went to Steven Spielberg after we finished Color Purple 25 years ago and talked about this film, and met with him about the film, and we met with Mel about this film. We met with a lot of people about the film. We'll get it done at this point. Those are the kind of things. But they're inspired by Fugard.
Right.
And work with
Have you met Fugard in your life?
Fugard directed me in Zay Smokai in Master Hair on the Boys on Broadway.
Oh, in that's right. That's
we,
what
I created the role.
Of course you did. Course
we created the role. Created the role. Willie in that from Yale Rep to well, I met Charles Yale Rep in 1982.
Well, this has been good. I know there's a lot of people waiting here, and I don't want to hold you up for forever and ever. But,
yeah, but that's what those are the kind of things we're doing. You know, if we stay, we're struggling. If we stay alive, we'll do more things. We have a couple of important films that we think are important. We're in the midst of developing. We've been able to attracted to. I think very important directors, we developed a script about an Adivasi artist who named Jangar Singh. Adivasi are the first people, Adivasi artist by Jangar Singh, who becomes who's a village person who is elevated to this extraordinary place, and when the Indira Gandhi. Government now draws attention to indigenous art, and because of his in the 1980s, because of his he loses some part of himself, which is commodification of himself. You know? Mm-hmm. He's a guy who didn't know how to use a toilet, and he commits suicide in Japan in 2001. We developed a script. We're developing a script about him. Mm-hmm. We shot in India. That's the kind of work that we're doing.
That's important stuff.
We got the rights to, with along with an Egyptian director and producer, to an important novel in the Arab world, Adurama Munif's City of Salts, mm-hmm. which is looks at the beginning of. Before oil was discovered in the Bedouin community. That's the kind of, that's where we're at.
I like that, man. That's good stuff.
This is what this is the kind Someone's of work we're it. Always doing. I can stay alive. I keep pumping it in. That's the kind this of stuff good. We want to do. You know, it's the kind of movies that we've been trying to and shift that, you know. We have, you know, and part of our thing is attach ourselves to the directors. We think are important directors. Elevating the work around directors, female African directors as well, supporting those efforts. Young filmmaker, I shot a movie, part of a movie, a young African-American filmmaker who directed his first feature called Muslim. It's the life of a young African-American who grows up as Muslim, you know? So those are kind of things.
It's good stuff.
It's good stuff.
And you're here to give this place kind of a boost as well.
Well, no, I'm
here. And I'm participate.
No. I'm here to get a boost from them.
it just gives you a jolt to be here. Gives you a jolt.
Of course. Yeah, it does. You know, it's very special to see all these young people. To see friends, comrades, people you see around. Yeah.
Dan Zebra, thank you, brother.
All right,
so much, man.
Okay.
I'm Mark Steiner, and we have been bringing you an hour of our conversations we've had here in Detroit at the U.S. Social Forum. Christina Arison, our producer, and I are here all week long bringing you stories from people from across this country and from our own city of Baltimore who are here to fight for social justice and to think about how a new America could look. And we'll be bringing you that again tomorrow at 5 o'clock. So join us tomorrow at 5 o'clock. Tomorrow, one more time, we report live from the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. Find out more at www.hopkinsmedicine.org.